Welcome to episode 4 of the Panic Pod. The title of this episode is called Facing Your Amygdala: Why Being Anxious is Brave and It Doesn't Mean You're Weak. How are you doing, Helen?
I'm doing good. We weren't sure how it's going to go, being 4,300 miles apart or whatever, but I'm doing great in Canada for Christmas, and I'm so overwhelmed and happy with the awesome response we've got so far.
Yeah, I think we've surprised ourselves a little bit there. I'm not going to share with you how many people have heard the podcast so far, but we're very happy with it. We're going to say this, and what a lovely response we've had. So you've gone back to Canada for Christmas. Do you know, is it actually 4,300 miles away?
It's about that, yeah. Oh. I don't know exactly what that is to Manchester, but I know that from here to London, it's like about that far.
I thought you just plucked that out of thin air and be like, yeah. Well,
that's just... When I was a kid and I was like really in love with the idea of moving to the UK, then I like knew that distance. I was just like, this is how far I have to go.
Oh, wow. Oh,
But yeah, we aren't... I like how we were joking around in like one of the first two about... like what our Christmas podcast would be about, like spending time with family. But I think these topics, as soon as you said the topic of today's episode, I was like, I'm really excited because I genuinely want to know this stuff. It was just like a smile grew over my face. I was like, yeah, I want to know.
Brilliant. Well, it's really interesting because in the practice, I speak to a lot of people who apologize for being emotional, apologize for being anxious. And in general, kind of hold on to this belief that being anxious, worrying, or panicking is a sign of weakness, which I just don't agree with. Mm. You know, it's a subjective term. I'm worried, I'm anxious, I panic in this certain situation. And for some reason, even on a societal level, I think a lot of people still perceive that as being weak, whatever that means. You know, but actually, if you look at the facts, if you look at anxiety physiologically, it's the opposite of being weak. It's actually being, you know, doing things, living with anxiety is incredibly courageous. I don't know what it was like for you growing up. What's it like? What does being weak, what does being strong mean, you know, emotionally?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point to bring up, because just coming from the perspective of in reality what our society thinks of people living with anxiety, I can say that being back home in Calgary with visiting a lot of my friends' parents and my family and the baby boomer generation, and how much they talk about, oh, anxiety is this thing that millennials are talking about now that they're using as an excuse for a lot of things. And so I think that it's fair to say that as a society, we see anxiety as weakness and not strength. As someone who's experienced it, though, I think you're absolutely right that when we fight our amygdala and we're fighting our physiological response to feeling anxious and do the thing anyway, it's on par with any other courageous thing that you could do that you're choosing to do without, like, someone who's not affected by anxiety but chooses to go out and, you know, you're asking a girl out, you're going up on stage, you're giving that presentation for your team at work. Like, all of those things elicit the same physiological response, and we consider people courageous for doing those. So
yes,
I disagree with those people around me, but I have to say that, yeah, I would say from a society perspective, we still see anxiety as a weakness, which isn't right.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think I absolutely agree 100% what you just said. It's for me, I think it's a view, a very post-militaristic view of what strength is. And perhaps once upon a time, given the wars and things like that, maybe it was something that was necessary to get through that. You know, maybe it was necessary to have that stiff upper lip and keep your emotions to yourself. We all pull together, and you know, obviously I didn't live at that time, so I'm not going to pass comment, but what I'm passionate about is kind of conveying the message that isn't needed now, particularly as we're kind of you know, it's often reported that we're verging on an epidemic of mental health issues, and when it comes to anxiety, I think it should be celebrated that people go out despite being anxious. And what I'd like to talk about in this episode is actually why it should be celebrated, why it is brave and courageous, why it is literally the opposite of weakness to go out if you're anxious. Mm. Because a lot of people, anxious people avoid. You know, if you're socially anxious, I'm going to avoid because of how it makes me feel. And it makes them feel terrified. You know, agoraphobic people, you don't leave the house. It makes them feel terrified. And what I want to say, and if there's anyone listening that does avoid because of this, or does go out because they're scared of anxiety or panic, I just want to say that kind of we're on your side, and I'll explain why. I'll explain why it's literally the most courageous thing you can do to face that anxious response, like you just helpfully said, wherever it may appear. You know, whether it's public speaking, going out, being in front of people, doing an exam, and all these different things. So yeah, that's what I look at there. It's interesting you said the amygdala as well. What can you remember about the amygdala, Ella? Go on, I'm going to put you on the spot.
Pop quiz time. Okay, so I'll tell you the way I've been re-explaining the amygdala to people, and you can correct me and tell me if I'm wrong. But essentially, the amygdala is something that we share with a lot of other animals that's lower down in our brain. It's closer towards the end of our spine in our brain, and it's this kind of on-off switch that helps control our fear response. Like you use the example of if you're stepping out onto a road and all of a sudden a car drives by quickly, you don't have time to rationalize that thinking. Your amygdala is what's there to just make you jump and like jump back and get yourself out of that situation. Similar to if you're like working at a computer very quietly and then someone spooks you, the reason that you have that response is because your amygdala has like fired up. So it's not something unique to humans. We share it with other species, but it's, I kind of think of it as more of like part of our more primitive part of our brain, which is why you can't bring it into the rational thinking. Did I do okay?
That's better than how I could explain it, really. But yeah.
Okay.
Someone who studies linguistics for you. In a nutshell, Ella has got that right. That's the amygdala, a prehistoric part of our brain that was there before the evolution of our cortex. Now, the cortex in our brain is the thinking brain. That's the stuff that where thoughts come from, you know. And what happens is, you know, it's, if you're daydreaming, the cortex is just there, you know, conjuring images and feelings and nonsense. You conceptualizing things is done in the cortex. But here's what happens, and just to recap, when we're anxious, what happens is the thalamus, which is our little motherboard in the brain, what that does is it shoots two messages at the sign of danger. Now, the first message is really important. That's the one that can save our life. So let's use an example that you just said. You're about to step out onto the road and you realize there's a bus coming, so you immediately retract. That wasn't you. That was the amygdala. The amygdala goes, I've sensed something, I've sensed some stimulus, maybe I can hear a car, I can sense a car in my peripheral vision, I can even feel the car, the heat of it coming towards me. Bam, the thalamus sends a message to the amygdala faster than any other kind of thought process in your brain. At the same time, it also sends a message to your cortex, which is your thinking brain. So that's why when you step into the road and then retract, you're a bit taken aback. But the second message that reaches the cortex says, ah, oh, the danger's over now. We didn't step into the road. Similar to your friend. You're walking along, you hear the bushes rustle, and you see something jump out at you. The thalamus sends a message immediately to the amygdala to shoot off. It just goes bang, you know, fight or flight immediately. It's there to save your life. Then there's a second message that's actually 1 second slower. And it hits your cortex, which is your thinking brain. And that's the one that goes, ah, it's my friend, it's messing around. And even though you know, they're messing around, but even if you're feeling kind of unsafe, what's happening is the second message is saying, it's okay, amygdala, you can turn off that fight or flight response now. You can turn it off. Okay. Where people with chronic anxiety struggle is that when the brain, the thalamus, and the amygdala interprets a danger as an actual danger, then we get stuck riding out that fight or flight response for quite a long time. And when we've done it for a while, in order to turn that off, you have to actually go and stand through that fight or flight response.
Right.
So picture me and you, Ella, we're walking through the Serengeti and two bloodthirsty lions come out and attack us. Now, obviously, we're really hard and we'd probably knock them out. But let's say we weren't feeling up to scratch and we see these lions bounding towards us. The thalamus, just to recap, sends a message straight over to the amygdala immediately. Bang, get ready, prepare. Adrenaline, go. Adrenaline, cortisol, that fear, racing thoughts, peripheral vision, stomach going, tense muscles.
Adrenaline.
So just in case. The second message, which takes a second later, also goes to the cortex. And the cortex goes, yes, this is danger. Let's activate fight or flight. So you and I are about to fight these lions, you know. But what people don't realize is that is exactly the same response to stuff that isn't lions. So if you're really worried about kind of going to a party because you struggle with social anxiety, you're not weak.
Right.
You are experiencing the same response than what you would be experiencing if you were fighting a lion. And that's how difficult some anxious people have it. The beauty of it and the hopeful thing is that you can turn off that response, you know, and it's called kind of exposure. But that's it. What people with anxiety do is that they suffer from something called second fear.
Hmm.
First fear is the initial jump. The second fear is what keeps that response going.
Right, because would you say it's because like your prefrontal cortex, that second message hasn't had any reason to turn off yet, is essentially what's going on.
Correct.
Okay.
So if we pick an example of social anxiety, big one. I might write my next book about social anxiety. So our amygdala interprets judgment, what people think, and other people as danger. So let's say I walk into a party and I have social anxiety. I see someone there, a very confident speaking person. Immediately my amygdala goes, my thalamus goes, ooh. The amygdala goes, ooh, and sends that first fear response. Now, people with social anxiety actually interpret judgment as danger. So if someone comes up to me and looks me dead in the face and starts talking to me saying, hi there, Josh, how are you doing, blah, 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 blah. It's really hard to concentrate. I freeze up. I'm having a fight or flight response. But also it's second fear, because then they're having, what if they're judging me? What if they think I'm stupid? What if they see that I'm not listening? What if they can see my thoughts? And immediately we've turned it off. Rather than going, it's just first fear, it's fight or flight, let that go through. The judgment from that person becomes the fear. And that's why we end up in our heads. It's why we end up replaying conversations, because we interpret their judgment as fear. But actually, being judged isn't dangerous, really, is it? But, you know, that's where people get stuck. How do you think that applies to other situations? I'm going to grill you again. You got 100% in the first one. What's another situation where that happened?
Okay, so another situation where we can't shut off that second response, you're thinking?
Yeah.
Yeah? Yeah. I would say, I mean, financial stress can be another big one, because, okay, so I'm starting up a business as a freelancer, so there's kind of a 9-to-5 mentality that I've had to grow for myself of, like, at the end of the day, I can't continue this work. I have to give myself a break at the end of it to go, okay, I've spent a good day's work and that's fine. That can be really uncomfortable if you're sort of like, you have an internal Excel spreadsheet with all of your like finances, and a rational brain could sort of go, okay, look, we're making progress. This is okay. I can only revisit this tomorrow and do my best tomorrow. But, you know, I got to sleep and I got to rest and I got to eat. So I'm going to shut that off. But if you have a financial stress that's a continual worry, then you can feel beholden to, I have to fix this problem even past 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock. I have to be thinking about it. I have to be figuring out solutions for it. Kind of the figuring out, I find I can, I can still get quite anxious, because it's like, there's a kind of fine line between like, okay, I'm working something out with paper and I'm working out the logic of this and I'm just working out how best to fix it. But if you don't actually do that in a constructive environment, if you're just like thinking about it, you know, while you're with your friends still, or while you're having dinner, or like while you're supposed to be relaxing and you haven't been able to shut it off yet, then yeah, you haven't been able to go, okay, this is it for the day. I'm going to let go of that stress for now, 'cause there's nothing that I can do about it. But yeah, like that, I mean, that's just one, but really like all different types of these anxieties that we're talking about seem to have that same rule.
Yes. I think it's a really good example. It's a more subtle example as well, because, you know, rationally, and, you know, I can set mine for this aside, you know, things are actually all right. But what you've done is you've interpreted that very minor fight or flight response, but it's still a fight or flight response, that worry as actual danger. So how many times have you laid in bed and just thought, yeah, I need to fix this now. I need to go over it. I need to get this mental spreadsheet. I need to fix it. This is a danger that I need to respond to.
And the what ifs that you talk about are huge with financial stress, because if you're, you know, just getting by with finances, then your worry is, what if my car breaks down? What if my rent goes up? What if this person needs help? What if, and you just, you play out all the what ifs that aren't even happening to you, but they're prevalent and they're kind of poking their way into your rest time.
Oh, yeah. So you know you're having an anxious response when you've got what ifs. That's it. You know, that's part. Don't get me wrong, it's healthy.
It's a simple way to look at it. You've brought that up a few times, and I'm like, yeah, that really seems like, if you can listen to your internal dialogue, that's a huge way to.
Yes, and observe it. That's why meditation and stuff is really helpful, because people go into meditation and think, oh, I need to meditate to calm down. No, that's not meditation. Meditation is just observing. But yeah, it's kind of this anxious response at different times. You know, even then, like example, lying in bed, feeling anxious, that isn't weakness. You know, if you know how to interact with anxiety, it takes courage to kind of stop it. It takes courage sometimes to go, nope, right, I'm compartmentalizing this. I'm putting it to one side. I'll worry about it tomorrow. That takes courage.
That's huge. That's absolutely huge. I feel like that's such good advice. That's something that I wish that I knew when I was younger, that like, that, and maybe it is sort of a thing that when you're young, you don't know, you don't have the courage or the self-discipline to make those decisions for yourself, to just tell yourself, it's okay to stop worrying about this right now. And if you're not in your rational mind, or if you, I don't know, like probably when I was younger, I was just seeing all of my peers and their anxious response. I didn't have any sort of role model to tell me like, you know, it's okay to take a break after this, or it's okay to stop worrying about this. But that's absolutely huge. I think you're totally right. It takes a huge amount of courage to say no to your inner thoughts that keep going on, just to say like, for my own rest, for the rest of today, and for my own like physiological health, really, is I think what you're doing there. You're saying like, I can't be in this state for 3 more hours of my day. Like, let's just, I have to be able to say no to this. So, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot more questions I could ask, but like, how do you build up the courage to do that kind of thing? But
yeah,
I just think that's huge within itself.
To do that, and why, again, it's really brave and not weakness to go out and be anxious, is that, let's take someone who's phobic. I'll use an example of myself, actually. So I was really terrified of getting public transport. So there's a trams in Manchester and the London Underground as two examples. So one of them is kind of, right, I need, in order to turn off this amygdala, I have to go and do it. You know, that's it called, it's exposure therapy. You've got to go and do it.
Right.
You've got to go and feel like rubbish and feel like in intense danger in order to turn it off. Because it's a trick. You're not in intense danger. Just the amygdala associates public transport with danger. And because I was avoiding it for so long, I reinforced that. So what I did was I got on the tram in Manchester and stood there and allowed it in. Now, talking about a what if, you should have heard half the what ifs I was having. What if you pass out? What if you have a panic attack? What if you... I did have a panic attack. But it's not if you have a panic attack, they can't hurt you. What if you do that? What if you're panicking? What if people see it? What if you throw up? What if the tram breaks down? What if you're insane? But then actually, with practice, over and over again, I got on and I'm just observing these thoughts. I felt really scared, but these are just thoughts. And it's just the amygdala firing off warning messages trying to save my life. But of course, my cortex, my brain, it can't really see any danger. It's like, well, it's pretty safe. And so it's trying to conjure any reason why. So not only have I got to be brave and go onto the tram to, because the feeling, I've got to be brave, go on the tram to listen to the thoughts, the frightening thoughts as well as the physical feels. Three different things I've got to fill out at the same time. But you know what? When I was on the tram for 5-10 minutes, the amygdala goes, well, I've tried to make you run away, but you didn't. So I'm going to turn off now. And your anxious response slowly starts to turn off. And turn off and turn off and turn off. But to do that, it takes so much bravery. So if you're an anxious listener, and if you're an anxious listener, you've got to go do that. Whether it's social anxiety, health anxiety, agoraphobia, kind of panic disorder, as in afraid of having panic attacks in places. It's okay. A panic attack can't hurt you, but you've literally got to go toe-to-toe with that anxious response. It is a false alarm. There is a lion you've got to fight in the Serengeti. But it's still really uncomfortable.
Yeah. Wow. Like, everything that you're saying just absolutely rings true. I can think of so many situations where I've been in a similar situation. But so I kind of want to walk through each of those steps again with you one more time. So, like, when you have that kind of anxious response, I'll go back to going to a high school party, like my first high school party when I had quite bad social anxiety. That will be my example, but I think it's sort of the same. That that you start having this anxious response, but I think there's two ways to frame it. And the way that you just explained framing yours is what I think meditation helps with, what cognitive behavioral therapy helps with, that you're acknowledging there's like this you that's experiencing all of the stuff that your amygdala is doing in an observing way. Like, you're observing all of the things that your amygdala is doing, but there's a you self behind all that that's able just to go, okay, now I'm sweating. Okay, now my stomach feels like I'm going to be sick. Okay, I'm having a panic attack. Probably not as calm and as clear as that. Not like my Emily Watford. Okay, we're having a panic attack right now. I guess this is happening.
That's so frightening. All right. That voice is so frightening.
All right. So that's not happening, because we can't be just as calm and collected behind all of that. But
What's the name of that character?
I called her Emily Watford because I wanted to make it sound like Emma Watson, because that's kind of where I'm pulling it from. But
Emily Watford is the character in our mind. It's just very rational and calm and accepting. Okay.
But like, in amidst that, your amygdala's going like, turn back, it's scary, run away. Then there's just this really calm voice that's like, okay, we're having a panic attack right now, I guess. All right. Okay, what happens next? And like, well,
I should have
gotten
you to read my audiobook. That's excellent.
I mean,
in that
I would
voice.
Have appreciated that.
Yeah.
But the part that I would say struggled with until therapy helped, until just learning more about anxiety, acknowledging my anxiety, was that gentle voice wasn't there. It was a voice saying like, "You're just on a train. Why are you getting so upset? This is stupid." You know, that voice that comes in and denies the validity of your anxious response. But like, if you had a different voice, if you had Josh's voice, like what you just said, this voice that's accompanying your anxious response to go, good, you should feel proud of yourself. You're doing the thing. You're exposing yourself to this thing that you felt anxious about. You know you're going to feel better after this. If you can somehow like have those thoughts going on a loop that's accompanying your anxious response to validate what you're feeling, then that's the root. As opposed to if you have a voice that's just like, it doesn't help to try to de-escalate your anxious response in that way, just to say like, it's like, imagine if a friend was with you. There's two types of friends that could be with you. There's the friend who's on the train who's like, you okay? Yeah, I'm really glad that you're doing this. You're getting through this. You said that you're really anxious about this and now you're doing it. See, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. Or you could have that dirtbag friend who's like, oh my God, I can't believe you're doing this right now. Like, oh my God, are you going to have a panic attack next? What's going to happen? Like, which friend would you rather be taking the train with?
Like an internal bully. Yeah, it's like that is such a. I mean, I call that internal dialogue, and you've just again summarized it beautifully. It's all good knowing the facts, but if you're not going to be your own friend, exposing yourself to your fears, exposing yourself is disgusting. Don't do that. But exposing yourself to your fears, you're going to struggle.
Yeah.
You know, and actually, what a point, yeah, because I do remember now, after you said that, is I remember the first time I got on the tram, and it was like, you're pathetic, you can't even get on a tram. You know, you used to be able to get on trains, you didn't care, now look, it's become a big thing. And you're
How
right.
How helpful is that?
Well, no, it's rubbish. You know, it's not helpful if someone's saying it to you. So imagine how powerful it is if you're saying it to yourself. I know a lot of people with social anxiety particularly have that kind of internal bully as well. You know, and rather having the rational kind of, whoa, you're facing the amygdala, the anxious response. You're doing this despite having adrenaline and cortisol flying through your system, despite having your blood glucose levels wildly fluctuating, despite every muscle in your body being tense, despite racing thoughts about imminent disaster and doom. You're still doing it. It's your fault you've done this. And that's, in fact, we should do an episode just entirely dedicated to internal dialogue. I think it's so important. And you're right, and it's good that, you know, thank you for sharing that you went to therapy, because that does help with that internal bully sometimes. You know, CBT is great.
Mm-hmm. Definitely wouldn't have had that unless, you know, someone sort of reprogrammed my thought pattern there. But, like, thank you. Like, that's the courage of what you're talking about. Mm. That's the courage, is where you're saying, yeah, this is happening, but, like, all of those physiological symptoms are also happening. That's not in your head.
That's very
not
real.
Just something that's existing within your mind. Yeah, that's all
very
over
real.
Your body. Yeah. You could have a doctor next to you telling you that all those things are happening. That is fact. So you need to acknowledge that. Otherwise, you're not going to get anywhere.
Yes, I would agree 100%. That's absolutely spot on. I think just in general, you've got to be a bit more realistic. If you are listening at home and you are anxious, don't get me wrong, that feeling doesn't last forever. And if you do willing exposure, correct? You can always Google willing exposure or exposure therapy. If you do it right, you can turn off that anxious response. I think the most important part that we've heard here is, in theory, that works. But it isn't going to work if you're not going to be on your own side doing it. And part of that, and that's what the aim of today's episode is that you are brave and you are courageous for going out despite feeling anxious. And you're right, there's no use looking around and comparing yourself to others. Well, they're not anxious, why am I anxious? Well, no, why? Well, good for them. Actually, anxiety is incredibly common, and actually you don't know what they're going through.
Exactly,
I stood next to a friend not so long ago, a music gig. He looked chilled as anything. And actually, you said, my heart's been palpitating for the last 10 minutes. I'm frightened. I want to run away. I'm frozen. I was like, I couldn't have told that. He's like, I know. I'm all right telling you. And I really appreciated him telling me. But yeah, it's remarkable. And despite being anxious, he stood there and listened to the gig. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in a nutshell, really. I think we should kind of...
Yeah.
I think we should... If people at home as well have any stories that they want to share... You don't have to go into specifics or share anything you're not comfortable with sharing, but if you've got any examples of your amygdala firing off and it causing you to want to avoid, or it's causing you to think, oh, I'm weak, or any positive examples of, despite being anxious, I went to do this. You know, a bit similar to my tram story or kind of
high school social party.
Even arguably. Yeah, social party. Send them in. We'd love to hear.
I think that would really give other people the awareness and the confidence to change your own inner thoughts when you realize that we're all having this all the time. We're all experiencing this to some degree, and there's no area that we can't relate to for anxiety. Like, everybody's going to have different triggers, different things that affect them. It could be something that you think is just like super strange that nobody else experiences, but you'd probably find out that a few people share the same thing.
Oh, of course. And that's quite empowering, really. One of my clients once said to me, he said, I know it sounds dead bad, but it makes me feel better knowing other people are suffering. And I said, I get what you mean. Yeah, it doesn't make you feel isolated anymore. Actually, it's quite normal. I don't feel like a freak or like this and that. It's just, that's what I'm doing. If you've got anything, send them in. Talk@thepanicroom.co.uk. There's talk@thepanicroom.co.uk. I just use that email because I don't want to have 5 different emails because I just won't check them. But if you send it to that, I'll read it and look forward to reading it out on the show. Do you have any concluding thoughts, Ella, or anything? I think next time we should talk about panic attacks. I think, you know, our podcast is called The Panic Pod. We should probably outlay panic attacks and some myths about them and some facts and try and make it a nice, reassuring episode. I don't want people to see the word panic attacks and think the episode's going to give them a panic attack. It's going to be like, no, it's going to be a reassuring one.
What you can do.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great one to step into next. Just one closing thought that I actually, like, made a note of when we were talking about, at the very beginning, talking about the older generations, maybe it was the World War II or baby boomer generation not dealing with anxiety in the same way as us. I would argue that that they did struggle and things could have been a lot better if it was more talked about. And I'll use the example of my grandpa was a pilot in the Second World War, and until he saw a therapist like 20 years later or something like that, he was struggling with PTSD. And I think that that's had effects on everybody in our family, just until you validate an anxious response. And it's never too late. It really isn't. Like, it was not something talked about when he was like 18, 20 year old in the midst of it, but then years and years later when he was able to go and seek help for it, it really helped rewire some of his thinking around depression, anxiety, all that stuff. And so I'm glad that he got that at some point in his life, but it took a huge amount of time for, you know, a conservative Calgary dude working in a low business to go like seek a therapist was like
kudos
huge.
To him.
Yeah.
Kudos to him.
I think one of the saddest
things about this current generation is such a divide, such a tribalistic divide between generations. But I think it's a lot harder, particularly for the older generations, to admit perhaps something mentally is wrong, because again, it goes against that prescribed view of anxiety being weakness. And I think that's a lovely concluding story to finish on, actually. Yeah, it doesn't matter how old you are, it doesn't matter what you're doing, it's okay to get help, because it helps, you know.
It helps. Yeah. Why live life in misery? Like, help yourself.
Yeah, okay, nice one. All right, well, we'll leave that there. Thank you very much, Ella. That's been, your feedback has been wonderful. Your reflections and your conceptualizations have been fantastic. I really appreciate it.
I just love this learning.
Nerd!
More pop quizzes, please.
Can we finish on that voice again? What would she say? What was she called again? That voice?
Emily Watford, thanks you for acknowledging your panic response and being kind to yourself when it kicks in.
Doubles
thank
up as
you.
A sat nav. Thanks, Ella. I'll speak to you soon.
Thank you. Bye.